I think. So we are holding on your Tes Amud Aleph, about the middle of the Amud. By the two dots, line begins Liboy. Okay. So we learned in the Mishnah, Marchikin Chagefis, Vesa Zevel, Vesa Melech, Vesa Sloyim Chol. We had a list of things in the Mishnah that have to be kept away from, at least to be Tvachim away from somebody else's wall, because the heat from them is going to damage the wall. So now we're going to bring in a side issue from a din in Hilchos Shabbos and relate it back to this, basically by comparing the lists of two different things in two different places as far as lists of two different lists in Hilchos Shabbos and over here that have to do with things that generate heat. The underlying principle is like this. In Masechta Shabbos, in Perek Dalet, it talks about the concept of Hatzmona. So you have a pot of hot food that you prepared before Shabbos. You want to insulate it so that it'll retain its heat through Shabbos. What kinds of things can and can't you use for that purpose? Now, Minat Torah, there shouldn't be an issue. You can insulate it with whatever you want. You're not actually cooking on Shabbos. The Chachamim were concerned that if you insulate it, for example, you might insulate it with hot ashes that still have like little live coals left in them, and then you'll stir them up to keep it warmer, and then you'll be over on the malacha of making a fire.
With hot ashes, let's say.
So then you start moving them around, and in order to insulate the pot better, and therefore you're going to make the live coals in there, the little bits of fire, the little sparks in there, glow brighter. And therefore, you're going to be over on the Issur of Mavir. So because of that consideration...
The coals are wrapped up?
No. The coals are... You have a bunch of hot ashes, and among the hot ashes, there are some actual... There's some actual live little coals over there.
You cover up the pot with cinders.
So because of that, and some other considerations, the Chachamim made a Gzeira that says like this. If you're insulating the food on Shabbos itself, you're not allowed to use anything. You can't use something that preserves the heat or something that adds heat. If you're doing it on Shabbos itself, but that's not what we're dealing with over here. We're dealing with if you want to put it before. You want to do the Hatzmona before Shabbos. So the Chachamim made a gzeira. You can't use something like hot ashes that will increase the heat of the pot because that might end up cooking it. But you're allowed to use something that preserves the heat. It depends whether it's a solid or a liquid. There's a lot of considerations in that. But besides that, also anyway, again, you have this whole concern about hot ashes that you might use. So therefore, the Chachamim made a rule that anything that adds heat, like hot ashes, would you're not allowed to use for Hatzmona. So we learn in a Mishnah in Shabbos that goes like this. What can you use for Atmana? What can you not use? Ein Tomin Leba Gefes, you're not allowed to use olive oil, Veleba Zevel or fertilizer, Veleba Melach or salt, Veleba Sid or lime, Veleba Chol or sand, Ben Lachin, Ben Yevashin, all those things you're not allowed to use whether they're wet or dry. Now, if we compare that with the list in our Mishnah of things that generate heat and therefore are going to damage a wall, we see there's a difference. We see there's one thing missing from our Mishnah. There's one thing missing in our Mishnah that's there, and vice versa. Our Mishnah mentions rocks, stones, sloyim, and that Mishnah mentions sand. So why the difference? Mishnah ha'chadikatani sloyim, v'laikatani chol. Why is it in our Mishnah it mentions rocks, but it doesn't mention sand? Or Mishnah ha'chadikatani chol, v'laikatani sloyim. Why is it over there? It mentions sand and not rocks. So Rav Yosef starts out by saying, the reason is because people don't usually do hatmana in rocks. So Tosfos explains. Yes, in the door over there, yeah. People don't usually do hatmana in rocks. Tosfos explains because there's large spaces usually between the rocks. Rocks don't usually fit so tightly together as to be able to insulate well. They would end up, although the heat would... So people don't usually do hatmana in rocks. Later on, in a few lines, the Gemara is going to talk about another reason you wouldn't do hatmana in rocks. We'll get back to that. But anyway.
The reason why you're not allowed to put the stuff to your name is well, is because this wouldn't be...
Because they generate heat. Exactly. So that we're comparing it with a list of things that are Moisef Hevel over there, right? So people don't usually do Hatzmona and rocks, and therefore it should be allowed. Tosfos, by the way, brings up a point that maybe, in fact, given that even though it may well be true that rocks do add hevel, since people don't usually do hatmana in them because the heat will escape through the spaces in the rocks, or for another reason that the Gemara is going to talk about in a minute, maybe therefore indeed you would be allowed to do hatmana in rocks if you so decided. I, it's something that's moist of hevel, and the Chachamim said you're not allowed to. That would be, you're not allowed to use things that are moist of hevel if it's something that's usual to use, or at least not even usual, but occasionally might be used. Rocks, which are almost never used for this reason, and for other reasons, you would be allowed to use it. And that's indeed how it's Paskin and Shulchan Aruch, and Tosfos mentions that. You want to use rocks, you are allowed to, because it's so uncommon that the Chachamim would never go around it in the first place. But the point is, nevertheless, so the Mishnah there doesn't mention rocks, first of all, because you're allowed to according to that, and second of all, because people don't usually do Hatmana with them anyway. So what? If you're saying it depends on what people usually do, if you say that it depends on what people usually do, do people usually do hatmana in shearings of wool or strips of purple wool? D'tanya, and yet we learn in a braisa, Tovim b'gizit semer, that you're allowed to do hatmana in shearings of wool, or with tzipet semer, or in pieces of wool that have been combed out, over l'shonis shalagamon, or with strips of purple wool, over mochin, or you're also allowed to use little bits of fluff, or wool fluff or whatever, like that came out of a pillow or whatever. But all those things are in metal linois, and all those things, you're not allowed to move them on Shabbos because they're all muktzah. Usually they would be used for making cloth, so therefore they're muktzah. So in other words, you can put the pot in them, but if you want to, you have to leave the handle of the pot exposed, and that way when you're moving them, you pick up the handle and the things fall to one side. But the point of the matter is that Abaya is saying people don't usually use shearings of wool, and yet the Braisa found it necessary to mention them. So you see that the Mishnah or the Braisa at least is mentioning even things that are not generally used. Right. So why doesn't it mention rocks? Elam or Abaya? So Abaya says no. The answer you have to say is, using an expression from Pasuk, Yagid Olav Reyoi, its friend tells about it, meaning sometimes we'll have, Abaya says, you'll have one Mishnah says one part of a list, another Mishnah says another part of a list, and we're meant to understand that they're interdependent. So, Tana Hacha Sloyim Vahu Adin L'Chol. So therefore, the idea would be, Abaya says, our Mishnah mentions rocks, but you're meant to understand based on that Mishnah that you can't have a pile of sand near the other guy's wall either, because again, the heat, it'll cause heat, which will, it'll generate heat, which damages the wall. Tana Hacha Sloyim Vahu Adin L'Chol. And over there, it mentions sand, and the same thing applies to rocks, that in fact, you can't use rocks for Atmana.
You can learn from both.
You can learn one from the other. Amalei Rava, so Rava says that, no, Yagud Olav Reyah, if you're going to say like that, they're meant to be interdependent, then what it should do is, the way you're doing it, where you're mentioning one, you have the whole list minus one thing in one place, and the whole list minus the other, minus one, minus a different thing in another place, that's not the way to do it. Let it list all of them in one place, either in Shabbos or in our Mishnah. Then in the other place, you list only one of those. You list only one of those items. So let's say, for example, let our Mishnah mention all five things that I mentioned, plus chol. Then let the Mishnah and Shabbos only mention, let's say, chol, or sloyim, or sid, or what have you. And then we would understand that it means not just the one thing mentioned over there in Shabbos, but all the other things that I mentioned in our Mishnah. So it can't be that. El Amar Rava, no. So rather, Rava says like this, Hosam Hainu Taima, Deloy Fatoni Sloyim, no. Why it does not mention rocks over there in Shabbos, because there's a different reason why people don't use rocks. Before we were talking about the idea that people don't use them because, like Tosfos says, too much of the heat escapes through the sides of the rock, between the rocks.
The rocks themselves are not.
The rocks themselves do generate a certain amount of heat. Abaya says there's a different point. Precisely because the rocks generate heat, because they mishatchi the pot. What does mishatchi mean? Rashi says it means they break the pot. Pots in those days were usually made out of earthenware. Oh. They're pretty fragile. You put them among a bunch of rocks. You're going to come Shabbos morning to get the food, and you're going to find your pot is broken.
Because
the rocks are hard. They could easily break the earthenware if they shift or whatever. Rashi himself says, and Tosfos expands on this, that everywhere else in the Gemara does not mean to break. It means to make rusty or damaged or whatever. So what does that mean? So Rashi over here, so Rashi doesn't expand on that. He just says that usually it means to make rusty. Tosfos explains, right, what the Gemara means over here, not like Rashi says that they would break the pot, but that they would cause the food in the pot to spoil. The rocks, the outgassing or whatever from the rocks would cause the food to spoil. Therefore, nobody's going to use them for hatmana.
The main thing is they don't preserve heat.
But even let's say you have the rocks packed tightly together, so you don't have choice at the point before about the heat is going to escape through. But nevertheless, if you pack them too tightly, you're going to also ruin the food in the pot from the outgassing from the rocks. So therefore, that's why it doesn't mention over there. And the reason why our Mishnah does not mention sand is because sand is not like these other things that it has intrinsic heat. What sand does is if you put something hot into sand, then the sand generates additional heat, which makes it hotter. But if you put something cold into it, then the sand insulates, it's basically an insulator. It doesn't really increase the heat. So therefore,
sand is different from rock.
That's the point. Therefore, so in the Mishnah in Shabbos, it's talking about putting a hot pot into sand. You can't do that because what will happen is the heat of the pot will reflect off the sand and back, and therefore the pot will get heated up further, which is also to do. Over here, when you're talking about you're putting sand near a wall, the wall itself is cold. So the sand doesn't have any intrinsic heat that's going to damage the wall. It's just going to reflect any heat that's applied to it. Fine, the wall itself is cold. The sand, you can put sand near a wall. It's not that the sand is not going to have any intrinsic heat that's going to damage the wall. Therefore, it's allowed. And therefore, our Mishnah doesn't mention it.
No, question. Sand is a meisiv hazel.
But only when you're putting something hot in it. That's what we're saying.
And rock is meisiv hazel.
Rock is meisiv hazel in and of itself.
Hazel means that you're adding to the heat that's existing already and not generating your own source of heat.
Yeah, well, that's in other words, that's the point. In other words, the heat of the pot reflects off the sand, and therefore it ends up warming up.
With the rock, we didn't say that with the rock.
So with the rocks themselves, no, that's what we're saying. We're saying that rocks themselves generate their own a certain amount of heat. If they're talking about like flint rocks or whatever that you use for striking sparks, then yeah.
If rocks that contain sulfur.
Yeah, okay. All right. Question is, I'll turn it over to your coil. Fine. Okay, but what are you going to do with the fact that Rav Oshia, in his Brisos, in the Tosefta, in our Perek, does add sand to the list of things in our Mishnah that you're not allowed to have near somebody's wall?
That's a different opinion.
No, the physics facts are the physics facts. If sand is, as we're saying, that cold thing, that when it's near a cold thing, it's going to stay cold, then what's the problem with having sand near somebody else's wall?
Being near a cold thing and staying cold doesn't mean that being near a hot thing is going to stay cold.
No, but in other words, there's no source of heat here. Why should Rav Oshia be worried about putting sand next to somebody else's wall? The answer is Hasan b'Misuna, because that he can be talking about wet sand. Wet sand already is different than dry sand. Rav Oshia being a bright, he having a brighter has to clarify things that are not in the Mishnah.
That's also in Shabbos.
Well, then the question is, Tana didan lusni v'loikmi b'masuna. So then why doesn't the Tana of our Mishnah also mention sand? And we'll understand that it means wet sand. The reason is he doesn't have to. Hatana le'amas hamay. Because after all, the Tana of our Mishnah also mentioned that you can't have a water channel in your yard near the other guy's wall, because even though it's very shallow, even though we're not worried that the digging in the ground in and of itself is going to weaken the wall, but the wetness, the water in it, the moisture in it is going to seep through the ground and damage the wall. Well, the same thing, wet sand. Therefore, the Mishnah didn't
quite. What are we teaching?
That's the point. In other words, that the question is, why Rav Oshia is saying sand? So we're saying like this. The Mishnah didn't have a need to say wet sand because we can understand it from something the Mishnah already mentioned. Rav Oshia, since he's teaching a Braisa, and a Braisa is expected to provide more details than the Mishnah, so he mentions another detail as well. He mentions that wet sand, he has to mention, more specifically, you should know wet sand is also a problem. Okay. The Gemara says, so what? Fine, but you already have, if you're going to look at it like that, hello, the Mishnah already mentions two things. The Mishnah mentions that you have an amas amayim, you can't have a water channel. It also mentions nivrechas akosin, that you can't have the pit that's used for laundry. In other words, if you're going to say that the Mishnah is only telling us things that we can't deduce from the others, we could have deduced one of those from the other. Why does it have to list both?
We deduced it from where?
Once it says a water channel, we should automatically understand that by the same token, a nivrechas akosin, and vice versa. So we see that the Mishnah lists things, even though we could have deduced them from each other. By the same logic, the Mishnah should have mentioned wet sand,
yeah.
even though we could have deduced it from the other. The answer is no. No, because we do need to specifically mention the Amas HaMayim and the Nechrefes HaKosin. Those two are important to mention because each of them has a feature that the other one doesn't have. The Iton Amas HaMayim, if it only mentioned a water channel, you would say the reason why that's a problem is Shem Dekriya, because they are permanently. Avon Nevrechas HaKovsin Deloy Kriya. A Nevrechas HaKovsin is not something that's necessarily going to be there permanently. Namely, it's a launderer's pit. So Rashi says that why is it not there permanently? Because you don't have any individual person have a pit like that in their yard. This kind of pit that we were talking about yesterday, where you have the one where you leave the clothes to ferment for a couple of days, and then you have the other one where you scrub it and beat it or whatever, wasn't the kind of thing that a typical person has in their yard. It's the kind of thing a professional launderer has them in his yard. Well then, a professional launderer isn't necessarily going to do that his whole life. Eventually, he's going to get sick of the smell or whatever it is, and he's going to go on to some other job. And then he'll close up his Nevrachas HaKosin. So therefore, it has to mention that especially, even though it's not something permanent. Nevertheless, you're still not allowed to have it there because the short amount of time you may have it there is still likely to damage the other guy's wall. But Amnon has a different explanation of it, by the way. Nevrachas HaKosin isn't necessarily always full of water. Sometimes it's full, sometimes it's empty.
What is it? It's a pit?
It's a pit with where you put rainwater in it, and then you put the chemicals and whatever in it, but still, it's not necessarily always full. Okay. And so Deloitria, Amalois, you would think maybe not. Maybe there's no problem having a Nevrechas HaKovsin. Therefore, it needed to mention that. The Tonin Nevrechas HaKovsin, but if it only mentioned Nevrechas HaKovsin, you would say the difference is Nishim Bekovo Kaimi. The problem is that the water is stagnant over there, so therefore it has much more chance to percolate through the soil, through the ground over there, and damage the wall. Avo Amasamayim Loi, but you would think an Amasamayim, the water is flowing all the time. It's flowing. It doesn't really have a chance to really get it to really seep through and into the ground. Amaloi, you would think Loi. Tzricha, and therefore we needed both of those. But once we have both of those, there's no reason to mention wet sand because there's no chiddush in wet sand over either of those two things. Whereas Rav Oshia teaching us a Braisa has to be more specific and has to mention wet sand as well.
Because the Braisa
has to clarify things more than the Mishnah. Then the Mishnah had continued, another thing that you have to keep away far away from somebody else's wall. You have to keep seeds or plowing at least 3 tefachim away from the other guy's wall. So, question is, Zroyim, typically Mishnah Machresha. Why does it need to say anything, why does it need to mention that you can't have seeds there? Obviously, how do you plant in the first place? You have to plow the ground. Well, you're already not allowed to plow within 3 tefachim of the other guy's wall. Automatically, that means you can't plant over there. Why does it need to mention it separately? Or the Rashba has a different explanation of it. Already, once the guy is plowing, once you're plowing, even if we're going to argue for whatever reason that plowing itself is not a problem, but plowing inevitably is done for the purpose of planting, so therefore the guy should have the ability to prevent you from plowing because eventually you're going to plant seeds over there. Again, the point still remains why you need to mention both. The answer is b'makholos yad. You could answer that the Mishnah could be describing, let's say, for example, you plant without plowing first. Let's say you dig a little bit with a shovel. You don't dig as deeply as you do when you're plowing, and then you plant the seeds. So you can't say there was a problem from the point of view of the plowing, but the seeds themselves create a problem, as the Gemara is going to say in a minute. There's a different explanation that I've seen that they had a method in those days of planting where you could have you'd take the seeds and put them on, you have sort of a handle of that way by which you hold the plow. You could put the seeds on the handle such that you're plowing and planting at the same time. You plow, and then immediately you scatter some of the seeds off the handle over there as you're going along. As the handle moves up and down, the seeds go. Whereas you don't necessarily have to do that. You could just be putting the seeds into the ground manually. Okay. Fine. Let's ask the other way around. Fine. What about the other way around? Why does the Mishnah need to mention plowing? What are you plowing for? Of course, you're plowing in order to plant seeds. And again, if we're saying that seeds are also then automatically the planting, that the plowing should be also. The answer is b'chodesh le'ilonis. Fine, but we could be answering that, let's say, for example, you're not plowing in order to plant seeds. You're plowing around the roots of trees to aerate the roots or whatever. Let's say it actually says the trees have been there for a long time. So the other guy doesn't have the ability to prevent you from having the trees there because you had them planted years ago and you already have a chazaka on them. Uh-huh. But now you want to plow around their roots in order to improve so the roots have more access to the air or whatever. that, and then you're within three tefachim of the guy's wall, then he has the ability to object to that. Question is, fine, don't you have a different problem, though? If you plant seeds over there, then you're going to have to water them. We already established before in the Mishnah that you can't have water or moisture or whatever too close to the other guy's wall. So automatically, that should include seeds. Why do we have to mention it specifically? The answer is Tana Be'eret Yisrael, because the Tana is speaking from the point of view of Eretz Yisrael. Which Eretz Yisrael live mostly, the fields live off rainwater. Therefore, yes, you can have, you planted your seeds over there, and you're not going to have to water them. Ordinarily, rain is going to fall and water them. But you were also to plant the seed there, not because of the water, because fine, the water would come there regardless whether the seeds were there or not. Not because of the plowing, because we established that we're talking about you planted them manually. But rather, the problem is the seeds themselves. So now we have to figure out what exactly is the problem with the seeds.
Didn't we say that whether you're in Israel or not, it's fine? What's this thing about
this? In other words, if you're in Chutz La'aretz, then you're right. You have a different reason why if we were talking in Chutz La'aretz, you wouldn't even need to mention that you're not allowed to plant seeds, because automatically we know you're not allowed to do anything that's going to cause moisture to be near the other guy's wall. But like this in Eretz Yisrael, where anyway, that you don't specially need to water the seeds, they're watered by rainwater. Therefore, the Mishnah has to specifically tell us, nevertheless, seeds cause a different problem. What is that different problem? Now we have to figure out. Does that mean, are you trying to tell me that when you plant seeds, like grain or whatever, are you going to tell me that that the roots go to the side? So are you telling me, in other words, if the wall is over here, and you're planting seeds over here, so you're saying the problem is, on the face of it, given that you're saying, fine, the problem is not the plowing, the problem is not the watering, what could be the problem? Presumably the fact that the roots are going to start spreading in the direction of the wall, and they're going to undermine the wall. The problem with that is, v'hatnan, but we learn in a Mishnah in Kilayim, in connection with the dinim of keeping grapevines and grain apart, which we've talked about before, hamavrich ha'gefen ba'aretz, if you take a grapevine and you bend it down into the ground, it's a very common thing that tree growers do it ad hayom hazeh. You clone a tree, but you take one branch of it and bend it down, and then bury one end of it in the ground. Eventually, that end develops roots, and eventually you're able to cut it off the parent tree, and it develops into a new plant, which is a clone of the original one. That's the word clone actually comes from hamavrich, it's called. You bend over one. Yes.
The word clone comes from that.
The word clone actually originally meant that. So you take a branch and it's a genetic copy of the original plant. By the way, it talks about chassidus, the idea whenever we say in a bracha, baruch ata Hashem, the baruch is also, we usually translate it as blessed, but it also is related to the hamavrich, that we're bringing down elikus into the world. We're asking Hashem to bend down to a twig of elikus into our world. So, hamavrich ha'gefen ba'aretz. So now you took this grapevine, you bent down one twig of it into the ground. So you have it, let's say it's going for some distance underground. Im ein agaba ofer shloisha tefachim. So the din is, if there's not at least three tefachim vertically of dirt above this grapevine, lo yavi zera aleho, then you're not allowed to plant any other plants above it. V'toni Allah, because then it would be klein. Tosfos discusses, by the way, the issue is not necessarily so much that the roots of the grapevine and the roots of the grain or whatever are going to mix. The problem is more that the roots of the grain may go directly into the grapevine itself, and that would be an issue. So as long as you have three tefachim vertical difference, that's enough. The roots of grain are not going to, I don't know, or vegetables or whatever are not going to extend that deep.
The Rimigash was
concerned about the roots mixing, but also about it mixing above ground. Therefore, he said you need solid rock in between. Yeah. Okay. The Taniyala.
So how can you say that for a wall you have to be 3 tefachim up away, regardless of the depth? And here you're saying only 3 tefachim between the two plants.
No, on the contrary. We're saying when there's a wall, first of all, when there's a wall, according to the vast majority of Rishonim, you don't need anything else at all. You don't need rock underground or anything. Only the Rimi Gash says you need rock underground, as we talked about yesterday.
Yeah, but 3 tefachim away.
It doesn't matter. No. If there's a wall, then no. You can go directly up to the wall here. You can go directly up to the wall. You don't need 3 tefachim. If there's no wall, then the din is if it's an individual vine, you need 6 tefachim around it.
Right.
And if it's a vineyard, you need 4 amos.
Right.
But we're not getting into that right now. We're just saying over here, you need three vertical tefachim of distance. V'toni Allah, and we learned a braisa about it. Aval zareya tasadon elah fa'elah. You are allowed to plant grain on the side, on either side of the vine. So in other words, if you have the vine is going underground over here, so we're saying you need three tefachim of dirt above it in order to be able to plant grain here. However, you're allowed to plant, even if there's not three tefachim, you're allowed to plant grain here or here. We're not worried that the roots of it are going to go sideways and end up mixing with the vine.
So we see
that the roots don't go horizontally. They go vertically. They go downward. So in our Mishnah, what's the problem of having seeds, of having grain or vegetables or what have you? We're assuming that they're all there. They're all basically the same. And because it also depends, you know, we're not necessarily, I think I've mentioned before, that Rambam draws a distinction between different kinds of seeds. For example, you have the kind where you plant whole fields of versus the kind where typically you only plant small plots of. Nobody, for example, grows a whole field, let's say, of oregano, for example. But you grow whole fields of grain, let's say. So there's certain things that you only grow in small quantities. So maybe those are the kind of zeroyim we're talking about over here. Anyway. So what's the problem with having seeds next to the wall? The roots of those plants are going to go straight down. The walls over here, the seeds are over here. What's the problem? If they're going sideways, fine. But we just established based on our Mishnah that they don't.
They don't go sideways.
When they're near a vine, they're not going to go sideways. When they're near a wall, they're going to come on. No, but the problem is, even though it's true, they go down vertically, but still, they machlidin means they dig down into the ground. The oruch brings from Rabbeinu Hanano another explanation, like they suck out the nutrients from the ground, umalin offer tichayach, and therefore they bring up the ground itself that's crumbly. So even though it's true, they go down vertically, not horizontally, but still they make the dirt in their area crumbly, and therefore it's too close to the wall, then it's going to undermine the wall. Then the Mishnah continued, so that's the conclusion, is that the reason why you're not allowed to have seeds, why you're not allowed to plant seeds within three tefachim of the other guy's wall, even when there's no concern about plowing, and even when there's no concern about watering them, is because the plants themselves undermine the ground. Then the Mishnah said, we said that you have to keep urine at least three tefachim away from the other guy's wall. A person is allowed to urinate next to somebody else's wall. As you have a pasuk that says, it's not just Achav, there's a number of pasukim like this in Malach, and I don't know why the Gemara picked that good one about Achav. Anyway, the Ebishter warns through Eliyahu HaNavi, I will cut off among Achav's family anyone who is mashed in Bekir. The simple meaning of mashed in Bekir means anybody who urinates against the wall, meaning any males. V'otzer v'Israel, and anybody who is controlled and anybody who is abandoned among the Jewish people. Meaning, in other words, basically the Ebishter is saying, I'm going to wipe out all of Achav's family because of all the Averis that he did.
Why do we bring this in?
The reason why we're bringing it is because we're calling the males of the family mashed in Bekir, implying that you're allowed, meaning if the Torah is describing, if the Pasuk is describing a person, a man at least, as somebody who urinates against the wall, implies that you're allowed to do that, l'chora, even if it's somebody else's wall. Mind you, I mean, Rashi on the Pasuk, Rashi on each of these psukim explains, based on Targum Yonasan, that Mashin Bekir has a different meaning. Mashis Bekiris Libre means anybody who's capable of having independent thoughts in the walls within the confines of their own heart, meaning anybody who has seichel. But the simple meaning of it, at least, is mashtin means urinate, and bakir means on the wall. So, okay, the question is, what does Rav Avachana do with our Mishnah, that you have to keep urine three tefachim away from the wall? The answer is, hasan b'shoichi. Rav Avachana would answer that our the Mishnah
bikir.
That bikir, which means against the wall.
Not against the wall, on the wall itself.
No, meaning right. On the wall, yeah, exactly. The answer is, hasan b'shoichi. Rav Babachana can answer that our Mishnah is saying if you take, for example, a whole bucket full of urine that various people have used to go to the bathroom and you pour it against the wall, that you can't do. First of all, because it's a large amount. It's not just a thin stream, but it's a large amount. It's all at once rather than a little bit at a time. So therefore, yeah, for sure, Rav Babachana would agree that will cause damage to a wall. You can't do that. But to have one guy standing over there and then urinating is not necessarily a problem. Toshma. Okay, but let's prove from a brisa that says lo yishbechad mayim v'tzad toitz l'shachaber. A person is not allowed to pour water next to the other guy's wall. Elim ken yochum en gimel tvachim, unless he keeps it three tvachim away. And the answer is hasam nami b'shoyfchin. There also you can answer that it's talking about wastewater. We're not talking about just standing over there. The question was because lo yishbechad mayim implies more. The lo yishbechad mayim implies it pouring. And the answer, actually, that's the reason that Marshall takes this out. That's why it's in parenthesis, because he says, of course, if the Braise is saying Yishpoch, of course it is pouring out. We didn't need the Gemara to tell us that. But still, okay, we have the Girsa over here. Maybe the Gemara thought that La Yishpoch Mayim can also mean maybe to urinate. Okay. But the answer is no, not necessarily. It can also mean taking a whole bucket and pouring it out over there. That we would agree you're not allowed to do.
Even Gimel Tzvachim?
Not within, you can't do it within three Tzvachim.
Right.
You have to do it at least three Tzvachim away. Toshma, lo yashdin on a mayim mitzvat kos l'shachaber, fine, but there's another braisa that says a person is not allowed to urinate on another person's wall, elim kenech men a gimel tvachim, unless he keeps it at least three tvachim away, and the braisa goes into more detail, b'med ronam amur b'kos l'vainim, what is that talking about when it's a wall made out of bricks? Rashi explains, bricks were not necessarily in those days fired in a kiln, they could just be dried in the sun. In that case, you urinate on them, it can easily dissolve them. Yeah, it can easily dissolve them. But if it's a stone wall, then you only need to be far enough that you're not going to damage. But kama tefach, and how much is that? You only need to be one tefach away, because it actually explains even if it's a stone wall, still you also don't want to undermine the dirt on which the wall is standing, on which the foundation of the wall is standing. But one tefach is enough for that. The shaltsunma mutter. However, if the wall is Sunma, meaning Rashi says, if the wall itself is built on a foundation of bedrock, which therefore there's no problem of undermining the dirt, then it's mutter, then you're actually allowed to urinate right next to the wall or even on it. The Rambam has a different explanation, actually, that Sunma means if the wall itself is made out of very hard stone, like, I don't know, I guess like marble or granite or something like that, something that's not likely to be at all affected by it, then yes, you're allowed to do directly on it. Be that as it may, well, this braisa clearly contradicts Rav Baba Chana. Now, fine, Rav Baba Chana could answer. Tosfos says that maybe he's talking about only the special case of Sunma. The problem is, A, he didn't say so, and B, the Pasuk doesn't say so. So therefore, you have to assume that he meant more generally, and we see from this braisa it's not so. That you have, in some cases, three tefachim, in some cases, one tefach, only in some cases, nothing. Not like he's saying across the board that it's allowed. Okay, so fine, it's a contradiction to him. Question is, fine, what do we do with Rav Baba Chana's pasuk, though? What does Mashtin Zakir mean? The answer is, because what the pasuk means is, not just the human beings, even the type of creature that normally urinates against the wall, namely a dog, still the Eivishter is saying, I'm not going to leave even that alive from everything that belonged to Achav. That's how totally his family and his possessions are going to be destroyed. For my neo kalba, name your dog. But not to say that a person is allowed to do that.
I would have said, look what these people are doing. That's part of what the bad things are about them, and that's part of why they're being destroyed.
But
we got this way.
Yeah. Okay.
If you want to destroy everyone, urinate on a wall.
It's actually not the only place. No. But he has a point that maybe, I mean, we do find that Achav was guilty of Averis Benodam Machavere as well,
right,
of killing novice and taking his field or whatever. So
right.
You could argue maybe this is part of it as well. The fact of the matter is this expression, Mashtin Bakir, you find in a half dozen other places also. You find David saying that I'm not going to leave anybody over from Novel's family, even Mashtin Bakir. Oh. You find by Yerovam's family, it says they're going to be destroyed in that way. Basha's family. That's the question. Lahura, if the Pasuk is describing them as Mashtin Bakir, in and of itself, that implies Rabbi Baba Chana is saying that's something you're allowed to do. But now we're saying that no, what the Pasuk means is even an animal that is normally Mashtin Bakir, the Eivishter is going to destroy those as well. Now we're going to start in on a topic which it's not really closely connected with anything we've been learning so far. It's going to be a discussion, a sugya in the halachas of Tumah V'Tahara. The reason why it's coming in over here is because later on in the course of the discussion, we're going to be mentioning grass or salt near a wall, which, like we said in our Mishnah, are things that can damage a wall. But the rest of it is that's the connection between this and our Mishnah. It's a very loose connection. But it's a topic in Hilchos Taharos, and in general, you know, since there is no Gemara on most of Seder Taharos except from Masechta Nida, the Gemara will often grab the opportunity to explain a detail in Hilchos Tumah V'Taharah, because we're not going to have another place to explain it. We're not going to have a Gemara on all of us to explain it over there. So the din is like this. We know there's such a thing as tumas oil. You have a dead body, or part of a dead body, in a kezias, at least of it, under a roof, and anything under that roof becomes tummy. You also have, if you have, let's say, two rooms next to each other, and you have a window between them, then the tumah is able to spread from one room to another through that window. What size? A window.
With glass or without
glass? No, without glass. If there's glass, then I would block it. Yeah, an open hole in the wall. Now,
this is glass now.
As a matter of fact, actually, there's a Mishnah that talks about that even if there's a screen in the window, that would be enough to prevent the tumah going through. Yes. Now, there's different kinds of windows for this purpose. Tosfos goes into the details of it a little bit based on the Mishnayos and all those. For our purposes, what's important is, if you have a window that's made in order to use, like you're going to put things on the windowsill or use it to pass things back and forth between one room or another, then the minimum size for it to be able to, for tumah to be able to go from one room to another through that window, the window has to be at least one tefach by one tefach. There's different other sizes.
Less than that it would.
There's different sizes for different other kinds of windows. For example, there's another case where you have a window open in order to let in light. Then there's a smaller amount. There's a kind where the window is just formed naturally by part of the wall collapsing or whatever. Then there's a larger amount. Like I say, Tosfos discusses that a little bit, but for our purposes, that's not really so relevant. But the bottom line is, you have this window that's made ha'osu l'tashmish, that you're going to use it to put things on the windowsill or pass things back and forth or whatever. The window has to be at least one tefach by one tefach in size. Any less than that, and the tumah will be blocked from going into the other house. So
it has to be all along, where there's one area that's narrow.
That's the thing. So now, if you have part of that window blocked off, then if you now have that the open area is less than a tefach by a tefach, then you're good.
Right.
Okay. So, Amar Tovi Kishna, Amar Shmuel, Rokik Enim Amayit B'Chaloyin. If you take a thin wafer and take a thin soft wafer and put it in the window, Enim Amayit B'Chaloyin, it's not considered to reduce the size of the window. So let's say the window was exactly one tefach by one tefach, and you put this rokik in there, it won't be considered that the window is any smaller now. Tumah can still spread from one room to another through that window. Question is, my area rokik? Why bother mentioning that that's true of a rokik? I feel like Ovanami. Wouldn't the same thing be the case even if it was a thick piece of bread? The answer is loy meboya karma. You're right. He means to say, needless to say. It's one of these needless to say cases. Loy meboya ova, needless to say that if you put a thick piece of bread there, it wouldn't work. Ova is thick. Kiven de ichli.
Bread
or whatever, or cracker or whatever, some kind of baked good. Loy meboya ova, kiven de ichli, since it's still suitable to eat afterwards, you could. Okay, you left it in the window for a while still. You could, you know, you have, let's say, the edges of it became dirty by contact with the wall or whatever. Fine, eventually, when you want to eat it, you'll take it out of the window, you'll cut off the parts that became dirty or wet or whatever, and you'll eat the rest. So needless to say, loy mevatalei. So therefore, needless to say, in that case, you're not going to be mevatalei there. It's not going to stay there for any length of time. Therefore, it cannot be considered to be mamayat the size of the window. Aval rokik demamis, the chiddush is, even in the case of a thin wafer, where it becomes disgusting, because since it's so thin, and therefore it absorbs moisture from the wall, and therefore after a very short time, it becomes inedible. You would think, therefore, maybe the person is going to be mevatalei there, and it's just going to stay there indefinitely. Kamash malon, that is the chiddush, that we don't say that. That's why he had to mention rokik. We don't say that he's going to be mevatalei. The basic concept is, when do we say that something can be mamayis, the tefach by tefach, is only if he's going to be mevatalei there, only if it's something that's going to be left there, Well, not necessarily permanent. There's actually Rishonim discussed on the basis of later on in our sugya, how long does it have to be the person is likely to leave it there without moving it? Is it good enough, maybe a day? Does it have to be a couple of days? Does it have to be indefinitely? Whatever it is, the point is that whether it's a thick loaf or whether it's a thin rukik, we don't assume the person intends to be mevatel over there, because since it is edible, at least part of it will be edible or whatever. Therefore, we assume that after a very short amount of time, he'll take it out of the window and eat. Therefore, even now, when it's in the window, it's not considered to be mamayis. We don't consider that the window is considered.
Everything is on the kavanah.
Yeah.
See, that's another material.
Okay. Yeah, okay. That's not a mitzvah, though. This is a, no.
It is.
Fine. Okay. The question is now a more basic question. But typically, the Havalei Davar Shur Mekabel Terumah. Why do we need to mention this detail about whether you're going to be mevatel this rokik there in the window or not? Don't we have a different issue? The rokik is food. Food is Mekabel Terumah, generally. And anything that, and b'chol davar shu makabel tuma ein echotes, it's not tuma. We have a general rule that anything that is makabel tuma cannot be a barrier to prevent the spread of tuma. You have all kinds of cases. A vast part of Masechta Olos is based on this concept that if you have something that's makabel tuma, then it can't block tuma going from one place to another. So let's say, for example, let's even say that this rokik was something you would intend to leave in the window permanently, but it's makabel tuma. So automatically you put it in the window. Of course it doesn't block Tuma from going through, even if the entire window was covered up with it. So what's the point of discussing whether
maybe
you're
maybe Mekabel Tuma, but who says it transmits Tuma?
If the rokik itself is Mekabel Tuma, then we consider it for this purpose as if it didn't exist. We consider it as if the window was completely open. Well, if it's completely open, Tuma goes right through.
But then the house, some houses will be...
Houses are not Mekabel Tuma. The houses are attached to the ground.
Like the car.
A car could very well be Mekabel Tuma, yes. So in that case, it wouldn't. But you have, there's a vast number of cases. Like I say, you have to learn the Masechta Olos to get the full flavor, or Rambam Hilchos Tumas Mes to get the full flavor of it. But yeah, there's a lot of cases. There's a lot of cases where you have something that's Olos is not one of the ones that has Gemara. That's what I was saying before. So we'll come across individual things of it here and there, but there's no one single Gemara. But when you do Rambam Shlosha Prakim, when you do Rambam in general Shlosha Prakim, actually Parakachad, Kirkuk Tumas Mes is not so long ago, it was a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, by the way, this idea that Kol Davar Shemakabel Tuma Ein Echotes V'Fnei Tuma, that Rebbe quoted it a couple of times in Sichas as illustrating the idea, therefore, so we see if something is susceptible to Tuma, then it doesn't block Tuma. By the same logic, for example, if you have a person who's susceptible to Averus, then you can't say, for example, that means that Bedakos, there's a little bit of something there that still needs to be cleaned up. You can't say, in other words, that this person is... Such a person, because he himself is susceptible to it, it means that there's something of that there already, and he needs to clear it out. It's the idea why, for example, in Tanya, it talks about that the Bein is Kirosha, because he still has a Yetzirah. He still is capable of doing Averus, so he has to keep it under control, but he has to not fool himself and think that he's a tzaddik. Okay. So, therefore, so what do we care whether you're Mevatel that's Rokik there or not? It's Mekabel Tuma. The answer is Shenilosh Vemei Peres. Fine, but you can be talking about a rokik that was needed with fruit juice, with something other than one of the Shiva Mashkin. In that case, food is only Mekabel Tuma if it ever became wet after it was picked with one of the Shiva Mashkin. Fine, so let's say this flour was never mixed, never became wet. It's Shmurta Matza flour, let's say, and now you went and kneaded it with apple juice, let's say. It's never Mekabel Tuma. There you go. So the rokik is not Mekabel. Because it's not the apple juice is not one of the shiva mashkin.
It has to have
one of the shiva mashkin. It has to touch the food in order to be mashu at the kabbal tumah, in order to make it susceptible to become tumah.
It's also this, I think.
It's not though. It's juice from apples. If you have water mixed in, if it's made from concentrate, yeah, and they mix in water, that's different. But we're talking about if it's natural apple juice.
Yad shachadam
is the mnemonic for the seven. Yeah. Okay. Therefore, so yeah, you can have a rokik that's not Mekabel Tuma. There you go. If it weren't for the fact that you're not going to be mevatel it there, it could very well make the space smaller because you're not going to be mevatel it there, therefore not. Okay. Like Moses Nesvi. Okay, but I have a basic contradiction. You're telling me then this concept that if something is Mekabel Tuma, it's not close to the Fnaf Tuma, but I'll bring you a Mishnah that says that seems to imply differently. The Mishnah says, Kupa Malaya Tevin, if you have a basket full of straw, the chavis malei grogers, or you have a barrel, which usually were made out of earthenware, that's full of dried figs, hamunachin b'chalon, and this basket or this barrel is placed in a window. Does it, again, this kind of window, does it block the tumah going from one room to the other? Royan. We have to look at it like this. Kol she'ilu yinatlu. If you would take away the barrel or the basket, the cholim tevin of grogers lamed of nasman, and the straw or the grogers would be packed enough tightly together that they could stand there by themselves. They could still remain there blocking the window by themselves. Chutzin. Then it's a valid chatzitza. The problem is, Rashi says, the point is like this. The chavis, the barrel or the basket themselves are makabel truma. Therefore, they can't block the window, because we just said anything that's makabel truma can't be considered a blocking. But on the face of it, well, that's what we have to ask. Aren't straw or grogers also makabel truma? If the straw or the grogers would fall out once the container was removed, they're not packed that tightly together, then it's not a chatzitza. The problem is, well, tevin chazi lebehemtoi. What do you mean? How can you use straw as a as a chatzitza? It's suitable for animal food, so it's makabel truma. The answer is besaria. We can be talking about that it's moldy, that it's spoiled.
Then it's not
suitable for animal food.
And
so that's the point. In other words, if you have this basket or this barrel full of rotten straw, you can't use it for animal food. Therefore, it in and of itself, it can be a valid chatzitza. But it has to be. That's packed tightly enough that if the barrel wasn't there, the straw itself would be packed tightly enough to block the window. Okay. Question
anything,
is
anything that's
oh no 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 food. Sorry it's, sorry it's not no 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 sorry it's not that if it's animal food it's makabel truma. No, rather no, sorry, let me back up a little bit. We're not talking about the problem of it being makabel truma. We're talking about the problem. You're saying that anything that you're not going to be mevatel there is not considered to block the window. That's why we said the rokik is not, even if the rokik itself is not makabel truma, but because you don't intend to leave it there for any length of time, therefore it's not considered a blockage. Lechura, straw, you would take it out very soon and feed it to your animal.
But
the answer is you won't, because it's spoiled straw. It's rotten straw.
So you'll leave it there.
So you'll leave it there permanently. Therefore, it can be considered a blockage. The problem still is chazi latina. Fine, but what about, you could still take that rotten straw and use it to make clay. You mix in straw into the clay like you did in Mitzrayim.
Not too good if it's rotten.
So, no, even if it's rotten, it's still suitable for that purpose.
Moldy?
Yeah. The answer is the ispe koitzi. The answer is that, let's say, the straw is not only rotten, but it also has thorns mixed in it. Now, the problem is, Rashi says, when they made clay and mixed straw into it, usually they would tamp down the clay with their feet, with their bare feet.
Oh, right.
So if it's got thorns in it, you can't do that. Therefore, you're not going to be able to use that straw for anything. Therefore, yes, you can expect that it can be left there permanently, and therefore, or at least long enough, at least long-term enough, to be considered that you're mevatelit. Okay. Question is, chazi lasaka. Okay, but what about, though, you could still take this rotten straw that has thorns mixed in it and use it for fire, and use it to make a fire. The answer is b'masuna. Okay, but we can add a third detail. The straw is not only rotten, not only it has thorns mixed in it, but also it's damp, so you can't use it for a fire. Okay, the question is chazi lahesek gadol. Still, you could use it if you're making a really big fire. You just like when you're making a campfire, you know, you can use, as long as the campfire is big enough, you can put in wood that's a little bit moist still. The answer is hesek gadol eshchiach. Yes, but it's not that usual to make a big fire like that so much that you'd be able to put wet straw like that into it. So therefore, under normal circumstances, you're going to be mevatel over there. Next, let's go back to grogers, hochazuleh. Why would you leave the grogers there permanently? Let's assume, fine, the grogers, let's say, are not makabel truma. Let's say they never became wet. Grogers are dried figs, after all. They don't necessarily have to have ever become wet since they were picked. But Lahura, you're going to eat them, so therefore you're not going to leave them here. You're not going to be mevatel them there. The answer is amashmul b'shei trifu. So Shmuel says it's talking about these grogers became wormy, so therefore you're going to leave them there. B'chein toni rav b'avur b'shei trifu, and so also rav b'avur taught a braisa that explicitly says that we're talking about where the grogers are wormy.
Say wormy, you might destroy your window.
Well, nevertheless, because the window is a stone wall. Worms aren't going to affect a stone wall. Okay. Now we have to next figure. Hi, chavis hechidamia. Okay. Now let's look at the barrel, though. We said you have a barrel full of figs. So okay, we're not going to ask about the basket, because fine, a basket is made out of stuff that can be makabel truma from either side. But a barrel is usually made out of earthenware, and we know a basic rule with clay cheres, when it comes to tumah v'tahara, is they can only become tumah if the tumah is inside them. It doesn't even have to touch the inside, it just has to be suspended inside them. But yeah. So high chobis take it down. No, you're thinking in later times. By the times of the Rishonim, barrels were usually made out of wood. In the times of the Gemara, barrels were usually made out of wood.
And you ever made that all the good taste, the quality wine, the whole thing is the barrel type of wood.
Chavis
meant amphoras?
Yes, basically an amphora, yeah. So, high chavis hechidamia. So, what's the circumstance? How is this chavis lying in the window? Id pumalabar, if the opening of it is sticking out. So, in other words, if you have, for example, here's the house that has a mess, here's the room that has a mess in it, here's the other one, and you're saying the chavis is in the window like this, with the back of it, with the bottom of it sticking out towards the side that has the mess, he'd go for teichus. Then fine, you don't even need to worry about whether the straw or the grogers are packed tightly into the barrel. The barrel itself is a valid chatzitza. As long as the barrel itself is not tummy, if it's tummy, then yeah, no, but if it previously became tummy. But it won't become tummy like this by the outside of it being facing a mess.
It has to be closed on one end.
And that's what we're talking about. If it's closed on one end, if the end that's closed is facing the mess,
right,
then it's not tummy.
Right.
It's not considered to be mekabel tumma in that way. D'hok kli cheres ain't mekame megabe, because a kli cheres cannot become tummy from the outside. So who cares about whether there's figs or whether there's wormy figs or rotten straw or whatever in there? Ella the pumma legab. So no, you have to answer that we're talking about that the barrel is going like this. So the open end of the barrel is facing the side that has the mess.
Right.
If it was just the barrel itself, the barrel would become tummy that way, and therefore so would the other room, because automatically then the tumma would go through as if the barrel wasn't there. But because
if the other end is locked.
Yeah, because the tumma goes into here, it's mekabel tumma in this direction. Once it's mekabel tumma, it's considered as if it doesn't exist. Tumma goes straight through.
And it becomes the walls are tummy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So therefore, the only thing that prevents the tumma from going through is the straw, is the straw or the dried figs, as long as we said, the straw is unusable and the dried figs are unusable. Tosfos deals a bit with the question about so what? I mean, why is the Gemara even asking that the barrel should be able to block the tumma? The barrel itself, l'chora, you're not going to be mevatel over there. You're not going to leave the barrel there permanently. L'chora, you're going to take it away shortly after. So Tosfos gives a couple of answers. One is that if we're talking about the straw is moldy and wet and whatever, or the figs are wormy, the barrel itself is probably affected also, and you're not going to use that barrel again. Therefore, you are likely to use it there. Therefore, you are likely to leave it there permanently. Then Tosfos talks about another possibility also, that maybe the difference is when we started with the sugya, we talked about the rokik or whatever it is that's in the window. We're not talking about something that necessarily blocks the whole window. If you have the whole kli cheres is exactly blocking the window is exactly this size and the kli cheres fits in it, maybe you don't even need that you're mevatel it over there. Maybe even just the fact that it fits, that it completely closes off the window is enough, provided it's not mekabel tumma. Again, that would require that the end of it that's closed is facing the side that has the tumma. But yeah.
If it's completely sealing the window.
Yeah, that's what Tosfos wants to say. It's completely sealing. So food, Marashah goes on to say that food, it wouldn't work.
Not.
Even if you had food completely sealing the window, it wouldn't work because you're not going to be remarkable. Unless, as we said, the food is wormy or whatever, moldy, wormy, whatever, where you're not going to eat it, then you're likely to be remarkable. But a kli is different.
So let me repeat. If it's facing the back, then we know it's not a problem. But it's facing the other way, that is a problem.
That's why you need to be filled with straw or dried figs or what have you. Yeah. Or another possibility, you could answer la'olam de pumalabar. You could answer that even you're talking about that the open end of it is going to the other room.
Then
why is it a problem? Because we could be talking about, it's not necessarily an earthenware barrel. It could be talking about a metal barrel. Metal kalim are not like earthenware. They can become tumah, whether the tumah is on the inside or the outside. Therefore, even if you have it facing like this, even if the mess is over here, if it's a metal kalim... Okay, because actually, Tosfos points out there is another detail. We have a concept in halacha called chedav hareu kecholol, that metal kalim are unique among various materials. That we learned from a pasuk that a chedav, a sword, has the same din, or any metal kalim has the same din as a cholol, has the same din as the mess itself. Meaning, normally we have like this. So a mess itself is an aviyavay tatruma. Someone that touches it's an avia voisa tumma in a sense. So it can make something else into an ava tumma. Another person, for example, who is in the same oil as a mess, himself becomes an ava tumma. he's able to be metame other people, other kalim, etc. And then you have the avatoma touches something and becomes the rishon latoma, the rishon makes a sheni, etc. However, there's a concept called cherev hareu kholo, that metal kalim have the same status as far as tumah v'tahara as the actual met. If you have a metal keli that's in the oil hamess, not only the mess itself, a metal keli. We learn from it generically to metal keli. So the metal keli itself will be considered an aviyah v'yisatumah. So in that case, the barrel itself will bring the tumah into the other house. Is what Tosfos asks. And the Tosfos answer is that no, not necessarily. So the Tosfos gives a couple of possibilities. One is, let's say you could have that the figs are not just inside the barrel like we assumed all this time. We could assume that, let's say, the figs are also all the way out, are all the way outside the barrel as well. The metal barrel itself is completely covered inside and out with a layer of figs.
Okay.
So then, therefore, so you can't say it's considered a metal keli for that purpose. That's one. And then, therefore, Tosfos says, in fact, that's why we use the expression grogris, because those are the kind of thing that can stick together and make a layer that covers the entire thing.
So the matrix will be completely
surrounded and covered with Then Tosfos gives other answers as well that you could have, for example, that the barrel, this metal barrel, is exactly flush with the wall. So therefore, you don't have a way of transmitting tumah into the other room. Only if it stuck out a tepach beyond the window, because then it would be considered an oil of its own. And then there's different other rishonim take other views. Some of them say that cherov hareu kecholo. I think that Rambam holds this way, for example, that cherov hareu kecholo means fine. It'll be an aviyah v'yisatumah, but not to the extent that it will. Not to the extent that when it comes to tumah, no. I think that what it is they say cherov hareu kecholo only applies if metal keli touches the mess, not necessarily if it's in the same oil as the mess. Then it'll just be an avatoma, and then it's not as stringent as the mess itself. And that would be another way of answering that argument. That avia avatoma would be only if it touched the mess, but not if it's in the same oil as the mess. I think the Rambam says that. I don't remember for sure. Definitely. Yeah. Okay. Good.
Yeah, I remember.
Okay. To be continued tomorrow, Beis Hashem.